Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Barling and Barrett on Crime. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'm joined by my very good friend, veteran trial lawyer Manny Barling. Manny, hello.
Hi, how are you today, Simon? I hear we have some really great guests.
We do. Also joining us this week are two special guests from Los Angeles, the always insightful Peter Haven. Peter, good to have you on the program again.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, you say that now. You wait.
I can't wait.
And from the untamed and possibly still unmapped wilds of Youngstown, Ohio, we have author, activist, bar owner, and general roustabout, Sam Murphy. Sam, it is always great to have you on the program.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for inviting me, and I'm looking forward to being in the monkey house, I guess, as Kurt Vonnegut would say. Welcome to the monkey house.
And I did tell a lie. I checked Google Earth, and in fact, there are satellite images of Youngstown.
Sam, you notice my behavior today? I'm doing my best.
Now, once we get around to the topic and about the shootings and everything, I'm sure you'll make a lot of jabs will be coming my way.
Oh, no. It's not. So, now, this might actually come as a surprise to our listeners, but Manny and I do actually plan these programs. And we had a delightful one laid out for today. However, some events on Friday made us decide to change course. Manny, you and I talked about the George Zimmerman bond hearing. Do you want to give us the thumbnail sketch of
For those who haven't been listening, Trayvon Martin is a gift that keeps on giving. Somehow or another, he's managed to replace KC Anthony as a murder trial du jour, and it's going to go on for months. So I have some quick recent developments. Circuit Judge Kenneth Lester, who's been on the bench for 15 years, was appointed to the case, done several high-profile murder cases, and apparently he's not too easily fooled, and he apparently listened to the testimony very carefully on Friday and granted bail in amount of $150,000 to George Zimmerman. Well, that just starts it. So understanding that, rather than get into too many more facts, let's just outline a couple players. There's State Attorney Angela Corey, who didn't do the work. I guess she didn't think it was important enough for her to show up at court, so they sent Bernie De La Rionda to court, who I thought did not do very well. And to make matters worse, I turned on CNN, and here's Mark Garagos ranting about what a horrible job. He was miserable. He's terrible. And I said, wow. I said, that's a pretty blunt description. And they pass it over to Mark Najimy, who caused the last judge to be disqualified. And the first thing he said is, I disagree with Mark. I think he's totally wrong. I said, uh-oh, we're going to have an opposing view. But instead he said, I thought it was worse. And he went off in an even a little farther description of how bad the prosecutors were. So before we jump into any of the individual issues, I think we ought to go around the board and probably start with Peter. And Peter, what were your impressions of Friday's hearing? And then we'll get in depth into the hearing when you're done with your general feelings.
Well, you know, I always think that you come off looking like a bad lawyer when you've got a bad argument or a bad case. And, you know, I didn't follow the hearing directly, but I read about it after the fact and the various testimony. And it just seems to me, from what I could gather, that the judge made the right call and that it was appropriate to post bond. And there weren't a lot of really good arguments to contradict that. The prosecution's theory that he's a threat to society just doesn't come across very well. And if that is your argument, I don't think any lawyer is going to be able to do a good job with that. I think the prosecution opposed it because they felt like they had to oppose it. And I think when you're in that position as a lawyer, you always come off looking bad, and you should try to avoid those kinds of positions.
I think it's a very good observation. If I could just add to that for a moment, they seem to really make a wide variety of statements, which must have been for the benefit of the family, about how they felt it was so important to keep him in jail. But when I judged their actions, I didn't think they felt there was any level of great importance really to it. Sam, I don't know if you saw any of it, but did you have any feelings from what you've heard about?
No, but what Peter just said is really a really good point. Of course, not being an attorney, and I do my best to stay out of courtrooms and all that sort of stuff, so I'm not really versed on that sort of thing. So it's just from my observation, how courts operate and this and that. I just have a general idea, is that Peter said a lawyer looks bad when they have a bad argument or a bad case, and they just do the best that they can up there. I believe that this whole thing has been a political. The special prosecutor made a political decision to charge Mr. Zimmerman, and it wasn't based on law. And I think we saw that. What I read about it on Friday, I think it was they did this because they feared another Rodney King riots coming. I mean, and that's what they did, and now they're going to end up making a worse case. It's going to get worse because, as you said, Manny, this is going to be the new Casey Anthony. I think it's going to be bigger than OJ. I think it's going to be bigger than Casey Anthony, and it's got incredible implications because of the race baiters out there that have been beating the drum about this all the way up to the top. The president of the United States got involved. Last president who got involved was a murder case with Nixon declaring Manson guilty, which almost caused a mistrial.
When
he got the paper.
Yeah. Well, there have been others. Yeah, the worst to me was Nixon declaring Texas a national champion, but I won't get into that.
Okay, I know that Manny and Peter are on the left coast. the actual hearing that they would have had to have got up very early to catch. I did actually watch it, and what I watched unfold was pure Hollywood magic. I mean, it was an ambush, and it was done with great panache. I'm going to start with a legal question. All right, the hearing opened with Mark O'Mara, doing a great job of laying down the groundwork. He wanted people to talk about Zimmerman's background. He wanted family members to talk. However, because of the high profile, it wasn't felt safe to bring them into court. So they appeared via telephone. It was great. It just laid the groundwork. And then O'Mara played his absolute ace in the hole when asked, who he would like to call as a witness. He said, "Thank you, Your Honor. I would call either," and this is important, "either Investigator Osteen or Investigator Dale Gilbrath," and it was absolutely breathtaking, or Gilbrath-taking. Gilbrath took the stand, explained that, he's an investigator with the state attorney's office. No, Mara asks, "Are you one of the investigators on this case?" Gilbrath, answers yes. O'Mara, I would consider your yourself one of the lead investigators. How do you determine your involvement? How do you define your involvement? This is all very boring. And then it gets down to the nitty-gritty. O'Mara, and I note in the file that you brought up with you, did you bring a file with you? No, sir. O'Mara, sorry, do you have anything other than what you just identify, the probable cause affidavit, Gilbrave? No reports or anything? No. O'Mara, did you bring any supporting documentation with you to the courtroom on this bond motion at all? No. I was not planning on testifying. I mean, isn't that an ambush? I mean,
no. It shouldn't be. I mean, he should. His office should know that he is subject to being called. And correct me if I'm wrong, Peter, but I warn every one of my clients and everyone involved with the case, be careful because the opposition may try to sandbag us and call you first. And I'm sure you prep your witnesses every time in the event that they are called or first, don't you?
Well, sure. I mean, he's at the courthouse. And if he's saying that he's just at the courthouse and he's not planning on testifying at all, then he's just there to observe the proceedings, and he wasn't aware or even suspected that anyone would call him. If he's saying that he didn't expect to be called first, that's a different matter. And Manny, you're exactly right. If you prepare witnesses to anticipate the possibility they'll be called out of sequence. What I'm gathering is that he was there to observe, and he didn't plan on testifying at all.
Right,
and
that's his exact words.
I know, but
not planning on testifying.
But
when you think about it, I mean, the bond hearing is to determine the criteria for whether he should be released on bond, and I'm not sure what weight the investigator would have on that issue.
No, there's a rule that many of us follow, and I think almost every lawyer should follow in this situation. If you've got someone there who's not going to, you don't want to testify, who could be embarrassed, then don't let him be in the courthouse. He could have,
yeah.
He just didn't belong there. If you don't want to subject somebody to this, but you know, the first rule is don't let him be there.
Yeah.
Don't you agree?
Do you gentlemen of the lawyers, and you too, Simon, do you believe that I'm not going to say, we're not either on a gut feeling or knows that their case is very flimsy at best, he's being a good lawyer and this and that, that he just knew that he could, you know, pull that trigger and he was going to hit his target? Because I think
first and foremost, Sam, you sit there and you ask yourself, what is the other side prepared for? How committed are they? What can I expect from them? And what do I think their weakness will be? And I can't help feeling that someone in his office, himself from previous experiences, just had a feeling that they were either going to come in like that, either because they weren't the bond hearing wasn't as important to him as it was to Trayvon Martin's family, or they had committed to the fact they didn't want to say anything of value. But what happens, and I think Peter pointed out so well, sometimes your strategies can embarrass you. And if that's your strategy, you ought to be a little clearer, especially in a high-profile case where there's so many people from the public who can watch and evaluate what you're doing. Don't you agree, Peter?
Well, yeah, it just the whole thing comes across as flat and strange to me. It just strikes me as one of these situations where the prosecution is, quote-unquote, opposing something, knowing deep down they don't really have any grounds to oppose it. We're not talking about the murder trial here. We're talking about whether or not he should be released on bond.
Right.
And it's a high-profile case, and I think the prosecution feels like they have to oppose it, but they know deep down they don't really have any good grounds to oppose it. And I don't, you know, it's hard for me to imagine exactly what the investigator was doing there, but he obviously didn't expect to testify. And I guess the only point that was raised by calling him is that, you know, they didn't really plan on putting up a big fight on this particular bond issue. And I think it's because there's really not a whole lot they can say. They raised two issues in his past, and they were very ineffective at painting a picture of him as a threat to society. They were just going through the motions, in my opinion.
Okay.
So why was he there then?
I don't know that. That's a very good question. I tend to think he was just there to monitor the situation, see if he could gather evidence, and they took advantage of it. I don't know what it really proved at the end of the day.
Well, there were what it proves, Peter, first of all, are judicial admissions, and some of those admissions cannot be taken back, and at some point it's going to embarrass him when he goes to testify at trial. And, by the way, that is the exact strategy. Peter, I'm sure there are opportunities you have where you can conduct what I jokingly call free discovery.
Yeah,
it gives you that opening that it shouldn't give you. And to me, it's an obvious opening when you have people in court that shouldn't be there. And I'm sure there are times when you tell your client, don't be in court because I don't want someone to get a read on what your emotions are, right?
Yeah, that's true. You really don't want to put your clients in position where they're going to get a shot at free discovery, especially under these circumstances.
Other than lack of coming up with the $15,000, because I guess he had to come up with 10% of the $150,000, why is the judge still keeping him in jail?
Because he hasn't come up with the money, and you have
That's what I'm assuming. They can't raise the money. Okay.
Well, some very few people can raise money overnight. I've seen cases, and what they do, Brent, I've had it happen here in California quite often. You'll have a situation. I had one involving gypsies where they just. The prosecutor was mad, didn't want him in jail, got an order that none of the alleged bounty from defrauding somebody could be used, and they tried to limit the source of money to keep someone in jail. So there's a lot of different ways to do it. And one of the things we're going to get to in a couple of minutes is the differences between the crimes and what they are. And one of the points that I'd like to make is when I see a judge do this, and I agree with Peter, they didn't have have an ability to really slow this down, because I believe the judge, looking at the status of the law, also has questions about whether he was overcharged. Now, if the judge has questions about him being overcharged, you can be sure that judge is going to be far more lenient on bail. Don't you agree, Peter?
Oh, sure. No doubt about it.
Manny, when you say overcharged, you mean he shouldn't have overcharged with second-degree murder?
Right.
Okay.
So, in other words... but of course, if it were manslaughter, it would have been bailed either way. But the fact is, that's usually an indication that the judge is not as crazy about the prosecution's case as they are. And I saw that a great deal. And let me explain why I feel that way, because Simon and I had some murder conversations that I wanted to pass on to our listeners and have Peter join in on. Murder is the intent to kill a human being without the presence of justification. If there's mitigation, it's still murder, but it's second-degree murder. And when you look at a crime, people always talk about moms, motive, opportunity, and means. But the real elements in criminal law are mental state, the conduct, and the attendant circumstances. And this is where we get to murder. And to give an example, we're going to look at the law in California, the law in Florida, and what we call the model penal code. And for those who don't understand, the legal commission got together and passed what we call model criminal laws to make it easier for the 50 states to adopt theirs. And by doing so, they intended to create some kind of guideline to have some uniformity in law. But our wonderful 50 states just can't accept those things, and they have to change them and modify them. So the model penal code has this really, it's always bothered me, a definition that's saying that basically it's attendant circumstances that explain what a defendant is thinking and acting and determines what he's doing. And as a result, they define second-degree murder as a sudden and intense passion resulting from serious provocation, okay? Now, to that, do that, you go back to whether you're thinking and acting and doing. Well, California says something different. It says that any murder that's not first degree is second degree murder, and uses two examples: shooting into a crowded room where you know somebody could die, or driving multiple DUI offender driving a car and killing somebody, not surprising. Well, second degree in murder in Florida has one of the more unique definitions, and it's murder with a depraved mind. Okay, what's a depraved mind? Well, it occurs when a person is killed without any premeditated design by an act imminently dangerous to another and evincing a depraved mind showing no regard for human life. Okay, well, we're going to switch to Sam for a layman's definition of what you think a depraved mind is. And I say that to you, Sam, because I have as much ambiguity as you do, so don't feel you're the first person who's going to say, what the heck does that mean? So jump in, Sam.
Well, first of all, I need a lawyer to determine what decipher what you just said and describing all these things. Jeez. The one you guys get paid
well, welcome
so much
to
money.
The jury. Welcome
the one
to the jury.
Get paid so much money. A depraved mind, you see, that's, a depraved mind could be anything, you know, I mean, it could be a sexual deviant, but that doesn't mean they all go out and kill people, they commit other things. I mean, you said the word, ambiguous, it's too ambiguous.
Right, and
especially
that,
when you're dealing with someone's life on the line, and which is Zimmerman's life, well, I don't know, I guess does Florida have the death penalty? He can't get the death penalty, can he?
No, it's life. In fact, I'll go through their penalties in a moment. In fact, I think I have them right in front of me. In Florida, I believe it's a life penalty, a minimum of 16 years in prison, off of my head.
Yeah, so I that whole thing you just said, I mean, it's just, like I said, I go back to the beginning when Peter was saying, hey, the argument wasn't that good, that's why they look bad, they had egg on their face, whatever. I always think that the special prosecutor, that this was a political charge and not a justice charge, and that's why it's going to get I know for 2-3 weeks his parents were all over the media everywhere, you know, with all the race baiters, you know, Sharpton and Jackson, Maxine Waters, the usual, and demanding justice, demanding this and this, and all of a sudden it became that's why it became the cause that it has, so, you know, the celebrity cause that it has, and they demanded that, you know, something be done. Well, he gets charged. That wasn't good enough. Then they all wanted to apologize. I remember the mother, I distinctly heard her on one television show. I can't remember what it was. She would like an apology. So he gave an apology, and that still wasn't good enough. No matter what this guy does, that crowd is going to demand his head on a silver platter.
Okay, which begs the question. All right, the poor prosecutor that got his private parts in the wood chipper was Bernardo Della Rionda. This guy has 29 years experience. He's a grad of University of Florida Law College. He's been a bar member since 1983, and not that it matters, he earns a paltry $150,000 a year. I mean, he was totally unprepared. He was sandbagged. I mean, who let him get into that position?
Well, I'm going to throw this at Peter. First of all, the first question is, did he lose the lottery in the office, or did they draw straws and did he lose? So, Peter, you can address that along with back to this ambiguity that I don't want to let go, because this is one of the things I talk often about, is that people have to understand how ambiguous the law is when you deal with these things. So,
well, let's deal with first things first. First of all, I worked in a large law firm in Los Angeles for about 13 years before I went off on my own. And I can tell you there are many times when the powers that be send somebody down because they don't want to go. they either don't think it's important, or they don't want to be there. They don't want that image to be put upon them, or they know it's going to be bad, and they actually soften the blow if they're not there in front of the judge. There are many reasons why you quote unquote send a young associate or somebody else, anybody else. Maybe he drew the short stick in the lottery. I don't know. But again, I think it all comes down to the perception that as far as the bond hearing was concerned, as far as releasing him on bond, I don't think they really had a powerful defense. And maybe one of the things they wanted to do was keep their best people out of harm's way so that when those people, if they actually have to try the case, their credibility isn't too badly beaten up, if it even gets that far. Going back to what Manny said, and I'm really I really appreciate it, Manny. It really is great to hear people talking about the law, because so often when we have these discussions about these big cases or any case, we forget that it all has to fit within a legal framework. And I, you know, the question of a depraved heart, you alluded to an example of it, and we can consider the definition by considering examples. And that's, I think, the way a jury will try to deal with it when they are asked to find out if this man had a depraved heart. And the classic examples are, you mentioned one, shooting into a room full of people. You may not have the specific intent to kill anybody in there. You may be aiming at the glowing chandelier behind that you see there. You know the room's crowded, but you're trying to hit one of those chandelier light bulbs. Well, that's a depraved heart, because there's a high likelihood, if not a certainty, that you're going to miss. You know, I thought about the example of the guy who likes to shoot the apple by putting it on someone's head and leading them against a tree. That is an example of a depraved heart. Another example was one I gave several weeks ago about drag racing in a crowded area. You know, you're not intending to kill someone. And in the case of shooting the arrow at the apple, you're specifically intending not to kill someone. But your conduct is so reckless, it's to evidence a complete disregard for the human life that you are in a high likelihood going to be taking. And in some instances, it's certain that you're going to take it. So I view these depraved heart crimes as simply a way of capturing murderers who didn't have the specific intent to murder, which is one of the defining elements of murder per se. And that really, if you follow that, that really raises the really interesting question here, which is, where's the evidence of the depraved heart of Zimmerman? How are they going to show it? And you know, I'm not sure which crime they would have done better charging him with, but I have real doubts about whether or not they're going to be able to develop the evidence to show that this was a depraved heart murder.
I agree with you. Gentlemen, how do you find the jury?
How do you find the jury?
In this particular case.
Cross your fingers and work hard, and you hope you're right. By the way, everybody talks about moving this case. I suspect he will do better in a home crowd in that particular area, particularly if he gets a predominantly white jury. And I would think the prosecutor should be more concerned about that than the defense worried about having a jury that they can't handle. What do you think of that, Peter?
I think you're absolutely right. If the jury pool is going to be made up of that kind of community, I think that the defense is probably going to want to stay right there. And, you know, the whole thing begins to smack of the district attorney's concern with the overall impact of this proceeding on the community. They may have a concern that if it's perceived to be a situation like we had in Simi Valley, you know, over a decade ago, where white cops were perceived to have been let go by a white jury pool in the Rodney King case, that led to riots. That may be the only concern or issue that the district attorney's office has in Florida, that they could affect the perception of the proceeding could have an impact on the community. But I think that what they're probably thinking is, these people want a trial, they want to have their day in court, so we're going to give it to them, and we're going to let the system play itself out.
Could they move it to a more minority district?
Well, that's going to get a real stiff opposition from the defense.
But could they?
And I don't know how that would work. I don't know what the rationale for that would be. We want to move it to this proceeding. I don't know how well that would be perceived.
I saw something online today that made me chuckle, but also made me kind of sad. And it was a comment on the case. I believe it read, if George Zimmerman is a white Latino, then Obama is a black Caucasian.
That's an interesting comment. Why do you find that, living in Los Angeles, you have to think about that a little bit, don't you, Peter?
Well, I'm just hearing, I have a lot of friends who describe these types of people with references to various types of foods, and I'm just trying to keep the food metaphors in my head. But in any event, I'm not quite sure what to make of that comment. I really don't.
Let's start with Obama for a moment. I find that one really bothers me. That how easy is it to label Obama as a black man? Okay, how easy is that? When the reality is his mother is white. Well, anyone who's ever studied Judaism knows that if your mother's Jewish, then you're Jewish. If your mother's not Jewish, even though you may have a Jewish father, you're considered to be non-Jewish. So who makes this determination? Who thought of all of this? That's the question. So when I listen to those comments, I don't find much factual or historical basis to support one way or the other. I mean, why is Obama considered a black man? I don't know why. Do you? Anyone want to touch that one?
I think it's a matter of perception. I think that people who want to view Obama as a black man will see the African-American descent, and that's the way they're going to label him. People within the community may perceive him as being, quote unquote, black on the outside, but white on the inside, and they'll perceive him as being a white person. Manny, I was grateful for your thoughts because my father is of Jewish descent and my mother is not. And I know that in Jewish circles, I'm not considered a Jew, but when I tell people of my father's descent, they immediately think I am Jewish. So,
I'm Jewish, as I told my wife. My first wife is Irish. We've had two children, and we went to a country club once, and they said, "Hey, they knew I was Jewish," and they told my kids, "You guys can't go in. Your dad, they said I couldn't go in because I was Jewish," and I said, "Well, can my kids go in halfway? They're half Jewish."
and I join both of you, and I also have a split family, Peter, and for that reason, that's one reason I brought the example up, is because my father was Jewish, and he was passed away. It didn't change. He passed away a number of years ago. My father was Jewish, but my mother was born and raised a Catholic, and I went to private Catholic schools all my life, but everybody always assumes that I'm also Jewish.
People see what they want to see.
My point, and that's why I say to Simon when he raises that, that's the difficulty with this is, it's that old line of those who are with you, it goes, or against you, or against you, and it's just another way to be against somebody, which is one of the problems in our country. We're manufacturing ways to split our country instead of unite it.
And this case is ground zero right now for that, Manny.
Oh, absolutely, and that's why it's going to be a focal point for a long period of time, because it's going to cause people to reassess that. I thought that Obama would cause that and bring some of this to an end, but he really didn't. What he did was increase the problem because it forced people to sort of take sides, and that's the shame of all this, is people are taking sides, and we're losing trace of the real issue here, and the real issue is basically justice, and the fact that Florida keeps passing these kind of funky laws that are just create problems that we don't need in our country. And this is one of the reasons I've been against this kind of law, because any law that fosters violence in a way that you can separate and use it to discriminate between people is not healthy for our country. I don't know if any of you disagree with that.
Oh, no, I absolutely don't disagree. In fact, I'm still somewhat in shock and awe, even though I've been here for more than 30 years. Why do the states have different laws? Wouldn't it be so much easier if it was just uniform across the country?
Well, if I may give a brief history lesson, in which I hope Peter will augment, this problem started our Continental Congress.
That's right.
Certain members of our country, Jefferson among others, wanted to ban slavery, including Franklin, and they could not get it done. So they just sort of left everything like this, and to appease everybody, particularly the southern states, they had to leave slavery intact. One of the reasons, and the real reason for slavery, of course, is the economics, because the South was built upon basically the wealth of individuals and holding individuals as slaves. So when someone listed their assets, if they had 10,000 slaves, there was a market value of those slaves. So someone could say, oh, I'm worth $750,000. But when you looked at it, maybe, you know, 740,000 of it was in slaves. So if slavery were abolished, people would have become immediately broke, which is what happened after the Civil War. So we had the 1830 Compromise. We had all those things we studied in school, Dred Scott decision. But eventually what came back was the issue that sooner or later, when you freed the slaves, would be economic ruin to the South. And that's what happened. So after that, it became an even bigger issue because the South now was poor. They were angry. They didn't want to have the North passing any laws which they had to live by. So they essentially have opposed any kind of change in that law over the last 150 years. You disagree with any of that, Peter?
No, I don't disagree with it at all. I think
pretty good history
that,
lesson.
Well, it's a great history lesson, and it's a very important thing to discuss in terms of dealing with the American democracy, the so-called Great American Experiment. America was born out of rebellion from an English monarchy, and when it was formed, the founding fathers got together, and they each represented different states, different commonwealths, 13 at the time. It's now grown. But in order to have a united force, they had to come together, and each one of them wanted to maintain the individual autonomy of their own separate state or commonwealth. But they also realized that they had to band together to create a stronger and more cohesive whole. And they decided to create a system where these two forces joining to become one but maintaining autonomy individually would remain. And it's a model that is repeated all over the world. The European Economic Community, was tried without success with the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, but it's a common sense model. You bring together individual groups and they form a whole, but you tell them they're each going to have their own autonomy. You look at the NFL or the NBA, it's the same concept, 32 teams, each making their own decisions, but there's a concept of an oversight that governs sort of minimum standards for them all, and neither one can exist without the other, so it's a constant state of ebb and flow. The biggest reason that states have their own laws, it's not all laws that belong to the states, but certain laws belong to the states, because these are laws that typically affect the state's autonomy. Laws dealing with making contracts, making business decisions, selling property. Also, laws dealing with crimes that are committed within the state. It's a very important concept of autonomy that if a crime is committed within a state, that state gets to decide how to deal with that crime. And subject to certain federal constitutional minimal safeguards, things like due process and cruel and unusual punishment, the trade-off is the federal government, the federal constitution will say, okay, you can make your own laws regarding things like crimes. We're going to impose certain constitutional safeguards, but every one of you states has your own autonomy, and you get to do, to a certain extent, your own thing. And that's what keeps the system working. At least that's the theory.
Very well said.
Yep.
But the problem is, and by the way, that term, as we all know, is frequently referred to as states' rights. I think too many crimes against the law have been done in the name of states' rights, and maybe that's
no doubt about it.
So basically, anytime anyone in this country disagrees with something, they scream states' rights, not unlike what you described, or someone, I think it was Sam described, as Sharpton and all the rest of the Motley group, who are always seeking some type of, you know, public acclamation, just constantly do. So what we have is a system where people use and misuse the very system that was designed to safeguard our country. And go ahead.
Both you gentlemen bring up, you know, give nice little history lessons. I really appreciate it. I hope the listening audience does too. But the one thing you brought up, man, he said, though, the Compromise of 1850, that's what we don't do anymore. We fight to keep the lines drawn. Whereas way back then, even though slavery was wrong, and they all knew slavery was wrong too, but they knew that they had to have it because that was the only way to build a stronger force and not be invaded again by whatever foreign power, or even collapse from within or whatever. They had compromises,
mm-hmm.
and they kept and all those factions which hated each other as much back then as we do today, it appears, they still tried to find common ground, and I just don't see that happening anywhere anymore.
No, and for much the same reason, because, again, it's about industrialization, and at that particular time, the North was more industrialized than the South, which is incidentally why they won the Civil War in the first place, is they had the ability, not unlike the United States did with World War II, to manufacture and create items of war faster than their opposition, and in the end overcame the fact that they had poor generals and too many other problems and still were able to prevail, because ultimately that manufacturing power is what saves every country and why we were just getting ready at the time that World War II ended. Most Americans who don't study much history don't realize the war ended just as we were starting to hit our real stride in production of goods, and I think we all agree that had that war gone on a couple more years, the world would have been we would have just dominated everything and everybody in our sight.
Okay,
Simon,
I'm going to jump in. I'm going to jump in here. We've drifted off topic, but drifted onto a topic that I really like. on Friday, Geraldo Rivera told Fox News' Bill O'Reilly that he had no doubt, the man's quotes, that MSNBC is pushing for the conviction of George Zimmerman, the Hispanic Neighborhood Watch volunteer. I believe that they are cheerleading for the conviction of George Zimmerman. I have no doubt about it, he said. Ooh. Are we looking at a case that's not only being tried in the court system, but being tried in the media?
Oh, I think every case is. Don't you?
Well, yeah, but it's not usually quite as obvious.
You know, when you have a case like this, this is a real lightning rod of a case for all the obvious reasons. It's got tremendous polarization potential and tremendous, you know, race issues at work. And because it is such a popular, and I use that term broadly, because it's attracting so much notoriety, all the things that go with that notoriety come along with it. People who have any kind of political aspiration of any kind attach themselves in one way or another to this case. And when they make decisions, those people, even the President of the United States, they think about how it will affect their candidacy, their election. The media, it wouldn't surprise me at all if any particular media member had a particular bent or angle, and all of them operating together represent different points of view and different angles, and they're all trying to get in on the action, so to speak. The only thing we can hope is what we always hope for, which is that, you know, the legal system is designed to try to weed out these influences to the best of its ability. It's always been designed to try to do that. And hopefully it'll be successful in you know, resolving this one on the merits as well. But only time will tell.
Now, Peter, as you talk, you know, it comes to mind, and this may sound far afield to Simon, but there was once a case, Sacco and Vincenti, about anarchy in the early 30s that drew these same kind of lines about who, you know, or what people believed in this country and who supported the Communist Party and who didn't, who supported anarchy and who didn't. And to some extent, this is to racism what Sacco and Vincenti was to the political beliefs of the time. Do you see any similarity in that? Because what I'm saying in a roundabout way is this is not the first time we've had a problem in this country. The topic changes, but the division is pretty much the same.
Sure, so, absolutely.
You guys brought some great points, and you know, my attitude is I happened to go online and look at the L.A. Times, and last night there were three murders in L.A. County, Brian Coleman, Reggie Burns, and Freddie Quintana. And of course, and I went around all these other newspapers. There was hundreds of people killed, wrong, just like whether it was second-degree murder or first-degree murder. I don't know all the details. There were four kids killed in Afghanistan on Thursday or Friday. Why is Zimmerman and Trevin Martin so important? The media should be on trial in this country right now.
The media has been on trial for a while.
And they need to be, and people need to realize what they're about. Thank the gods for the Internet, what we're on right now, and otherwise, and trying to get the word out there, because this mainstream media, it's called, is fanning the flames of the racial division, you know, all for ratings, all for money, of course, and this, that, and the other thing. But it's terrible. It's getting out of hand. Why this case? People are getting human beings are butchering each other all over the world. And
well, you know, it's very interesting.
It's going on, and it's ridiculous. It's all for an agenda. It's disgusting, and I hope that this show and other people and people around the world put our media on trial and rightfully turn the off switch on them.
Well, but that's not what happens. So what happens in reality is that they actually, if people would do that, they would probably stop what they're doing. But people don't do that.
I think a lot of people do. I think, unfortunately, you know, when you deal with, you know, more people know who Snooki is on, you know, reality TV show and what's happened, as they do know who, what Paris Hilton's famous for being famous, or the Kardashians, or and I know all the names, too, because I read a lot and I see a lot of things, but I don't go into their lifestyles or this and that. I think it's a joke. It's destroying our culture and whatnot to make it easy to polarize ourselves.
You know, one of the difficulties is that, generally speaking, in our culture and in most cultures, well, not most cultures, but our culture in particular, the media is relatively untouchable from a legal point of view. They have, you know, we believe in free speech. It's an important part of a democracy. And the media has a lot of free rein. And because of that, you see gross abuses of the media privilege. And it's rare when they cross the line. But they do run amok.
But they
you know,
have been crossing the lines a lot more. Oberman. And you see them all getting banked.
You see it every now and then, like that British scandal where they were bribing people,
right.
And the Murdoch assistant,
right,
got fired as a result of that. But unfortunately, the media has a great deal of freedom to kind of do whatever it wants, and there are some checks and balances on it: defamation, libel lawsuits, when they cross the line and they actually break laws. But for the most part, it's very difficult to rein them in. It's up to the court of public opinion to evaluate it.
Do you three have any doubt that come at one of the debates, we will have whoever the commentator or moderator will say, Mr. President, Mr. Romney, what's your take on Trevor Martin and George Zimmerman?
The only question is how quickly they say it.
Okay. One, they get the, they rile their bases up, but two, they deflect from the real issues that no one's really talking about. And we all know that.
Yeah.
I had anybody talk about the housing collapse. No one's even doing anything about that, and that's still affecting all of our lives and our economy.
You know, when they have these debates, the debates to a certain extent are a function of an agreement. You know, the candidates agree to appear, they agree upon certain forums and that sort of thing. It's possible that an agreement could be struck in advance that they won't ask that question, and it's also possible that the candidates will have an agreement between themselves that say they won't answer that question. And the most likely scenario is you end up with a very vanilla response regardless. We're going to wait for the system. We believe in that justice will come out, and we wait for it to happen. Unless one of them is really running behind in the polls and they really want to scramble to create a lightning rod, I suspect that's what you'll see.
But where does news end and commentary begin?
Not with News of the World, Simon, okay? Just so you know that.
I know, and I used to really enjoy reading it.
News of the World was Murdoch's disaster in England, but I consider most of what he does a disaster. So here we are in the United States, and one of the driving powers behind this is Murdoch, who owns Fox News.
And sure makes a lot of money.
Yep.
Yeah,
right.
And by the way, I have a different view as an American than a lot of people. I personally do not believe that we should allow people who live in foreign countries, particularly people like Murdoch, to own the news in our country. And therein lies one of the problems. And I don't believe that Murdoch has any commitment to any principle which the United States stands for. And that makes it easy for him to put out this kind of news without any kind of any hindrance or self-control. He certainly isn't a Ben Franklin, who started newspapers in this country to be what they are, nor an Edward R. Murrow, whose devotion to this country was unmeasured during World War II. So when I look at this, I go, hey, we've got a really interesting owner of Fox News. The problem is he doesn't care. So I don't, maybe some of you disagree with me on that regard, but that's a problem in our country.
Yeah, the short answer to Simon's question is it's very difficult to draw the line. I used to work as a journalist in college a long time ago, and I had a young reporter who came to me, and he was really adamant about being factual. And sometimes we'd change the words in his story, and he'd go berserk, and he'd say, that's not news reporting, that's editorializing. And I always reminded of that whenever we have this kind of discussion. No matter how vigilant you are, no matter how much you want to just portray the news, it's very hard to keep unfiltered out of that portrayal whatever subjective points of view you have, even in the way you portray it. So I don't think there is a clear line. I think it's all a little bit of a mishmash across the board.
And you're absolutely right, Peter. And I, do all that sort of stuff too, as being an author, and I was in journalism, and those things. And it's very hard to keep your bias out. But on the same token, when I hear about producers altering people's, slicing and dicing and editing themselves to make it look like the guy's guilty or less bad. I think someone from NBC got in trouble for just doing that. I think they were fired from their job for altering, what was said or what wasn't said in regards to the case we're talking about. They were fired. What really got to me were the pictures, because the picture's worth a million words in today's society. Everyone's got cameras on their cell phones, and they're waiting for their gotcha moment. But the pictures I was seeing when I first heard about this case, and of course it was months after the tragedy took place, was I saw a picture of this a kid looked like he was 12 years old against bigger brute of a man. You could tell he had an orange jumpsuit on at some point. I don't know if that he was even colored in, and that's what I saw. And it took weeks before you saw real pictures of Trevor Martin at age 17 looked like and what George Zimmerman looks like. And they were definitely, the media was definitely trying to influence what people thought right from the get-go on this case.
Well, I'm not so sure that initially that wasn't the only thing available to him. It's not like at that age you can...
Oh, not in today's Facebook. Oh, come on, not in today's social networking. Heck, you go to someone's Facebook page and find... And he's on it, too. That's where they found pictures. They decided what went on. That was ultimate in-your-face. This is what we're taking outside. They're all guilty of it.
Yeah, I didn't see the Facebook, so I don't have a comment.
Yeah, I mean, they're all guilty of it. It took a while for it to filter out.
Well, no, I know it did, but I wasn't sure what the reasons were. I thought some of it was just, just not being prepared, you know, not having it together. So
well, if that's the case, a pox on the house for not being prepared, just like we started the whole conversation, the investigator called in wasn't prepared, right?
Yeah, right. Well, that is a problem in our country, too, is that this rush to meet the Internet demands caused people to put out information too quickly without getting additional sources.
That's a good point, too.
Yeah. One of my friends is the head of AP in Los Angeles, and he rails about this all the time, what they go through to verify his story while some people in the media, and he points his finger at Fox as one of them, will just publish anything without checking it out. So you have to force yourself every day not to jump on that bandwagon and race your opposition to the, you know, we used to race the courthouse. Remember that old expression, Peter? Well, now people race to the newspapers.
Yep. There's a constant rush to be the person who breaks the big story, who beats you to the punch, and it has a kind of inflationary effect on news. There's a tremendous desire to want to make things sensational, and it's a very difficult impulse to fight and counteract.
Okay, I have to defend the news here.
Really? Did this impulse come upon you quickly, or did you think about this?
Right now, there's a case heading into the courtroom, I think tomorrow. It's the John Edwards scandal. That story was actually researched and, to a certain extent, broken by a friend of mine, but just an independent blogger. And he finally reached the stage where he said, you know, I can't handle this anymore. Someone's going to crush me. And he gave it to the National Enquirer. Now, you know, we don't have much faith in the National Enquirer.
They're the best news around.
Right, you know, it's fun to read while you're in line for the checkout at your supermarket. But he was exactly right. He got it right. But he knew that that story had... He'd run as far as he could with it. No one wanted to touch it. It was toxic.
Well, that's not uncommon. And having dealt a fair amount with them, I can understand. They just don't care if they're sued, is my opinion of them. I had an instance in a case involving Clint Eastwood where they published a story, and when they got caught, they attributed the source of the story to Clint Eastwood's PR agent, who happened to be at the Cannes Film Festival with my wife and I. And they claimed that he broke this story. We're all like, what? And Eastwood ended up winning a high six-figure amount of money, which he donated to a journalism school. And then when Tom Selleck had the same thing happen, and he won about $800,000 from the Enquirer, he donated the money to USC for classes on ethical journalism. And I don't think they've really helped, but they've certainly been doing that.
Simon, you raise a good point, which is that, and we've talked about it. You know, one of the primary purposes of the news and the commentary and the social media is to expose things. And As with anything, there are extremely good and important aspects of it, and there are extremely problematic aspects of it. You know, I always like to think that the greatest strengths that people have are also their greatest weaknesses, and vice versa. And the only way to really view any of this is for every person to try to be mindful of the information they're getting, where they're getting it from, and what potential biases may be affecting it. You know, one of the things that Manny and I have to get beaten in the head with every single day is we're always told about something called hearsay, and we have to live with it. It's a shadowy threat on every piece of evidence that we ever want to bring into a courtroom. Well, that's just hearsay. That was said outside the courtroom. But really, everyone has to be kind of mindful of it. We never know where the sources are coming from, which ones we can really trust and which ones we can't, and we all just have to do our best to make our own decisions about that.
I was always told in journalism school, you had to trust and verify, but have three damn sources that all said the same thing.
Yeah.
If you couldn't get a second one, then you couldn't believe the first one. Then once you got the second one, you had to get the third one.
In trial, you've proven something when you can get three people to say it.
I'm never sure in trial, Peter, when you do prove something, are you?
Yeah, I'm never sure either. You can get 100 people to say it. No, there's something powerful about threes, and I agree with you. It's a powerful thing if you can get three separate incidences of anything.
But, Simon, you bring up your friend did a great, you know, that there's a lot of bloggers out there, and I couldn't even touch on very few of them. There's thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands out there that have done a lot of things with the social network that are mainstream media can't. For instance, we've been able to see YouTubes and uploads of these of what's going on in Syria, what's happened around the world with revolutions, and to get the word out. Our mainstream media doesn't cover that. You know, I mean, for the most part, if it wasn't for these people on the street, almost everybody's an instant reporter now with a laptop and a cell phone. They do get stuff out there.
Yeah. Well, let me point something out for you, Sam. And I think this, and Peter will agree with this analogy. Basically, what we have now is the modern version of the Gutenberg Bible. We now have an ability for the common man to put out information that's not sanctioned by the press, the organized forces of, whatever form God controls our government. And to a great extent, that was the undoing of many, particularly the Catholic Church, because it could no longer control the dissemination of information. And out of that, human beings started sending, pamphlets out. How could we have had something as simple as the Revolutionary War? Or how could the United States have survived without our dear friend, Ben Franklin, doing what he was doing? I mean, so in the end, this has replaced Franklin and the press and all that with a new form of press, which now has 1 million, or actually in this case, maybe 100 to 150 million different reporters, and throw in the cell phones and the other new media. It's really hard to keep a secret in this world. And one of the shows, as Simon mentioned in the beginning, we were going to do a show on privacy, because privacy is becoming such a big issue. So we're constantly, as a race and as a government, kind of juggling the differences between freedom and privacy. And this is a classic example of it, isn't it?
Well, there's a bigger issue here. That fine line actually is not really a fine line, you know, between talking bullshit and talking reality.
Well, that you said about Fox, too, by many people.
Right.
There are people who say that about Fox, aren't there?
Yeah. I mean, what can you believe? Yeah. Do you believe Fox? Do you believe CNN? Do you believe MSNBC? I mean, do you believe that these are unbiased sources of news? Oh, excuse me.
What I believe is that Edward R. Murrow is turning over in his grave. What I believe.
Many times.
Many times. Probably spinning at full speed. And
but, Manny, did you see that? I bet you did. The movie that Clooney did with him? about Edward yeah, Elmore.
Good night, good luck.
Right. Do you remember when he went up to talk to, the great actor played him, Frank Langella, played, I think, Paley, the head of the CBS?
Uh-huh.
And he was talking about,
William.
He was making this great case for why the news had to be important and get the word out and educate people and all that. And Paley turned to him and said, the news division cost me more money than all and doesn't make me a penny. All the other stuff makes me a penny. Be grateful. Be grateful you got a 15-minute show. Isn't that what it's all about? It's always about the dollars, right?
And you know what the sad change is? Do you know that right now the news is the most profitable area of network television?
Yes, that is funny. You stole my thunder. Isn't that, back then it wasn't.
I know that. I don't know if there was anyone in this world I admired more than Edward R. Murrow. He was my idol growing up. I watched every show. I can't forget the night that he went off on McCarthy and McCarthyism, and was a great motivator in my desire ultimately to be a lawyer, along with some local lawyers in my neighborhood. But that truth that he sought and that truth that he cherished is something that's absent from our society. But we need to remember that truth of not only his, Cronkite, Severide, and all the other people so respected were grounded in World War II, where their vision of democracy and what went on in the world not only schooled them in the importance of all this, but also made them cherish the liberty that we all share and sometimes don't pay enough respect for. And I'm sure that each of you has some feeling that right now in our society we have lost vision about what's important to us.
All right. I'm going to jump in and do my usual trick of completely changing the subject. What's next in the Zimmerman-Trey Martin thing? I mean, Zimmerman's bond hearing, he has to come up with $15,000, and stories are that the family's having a bit of an issue raising that amount of money, and I'll bet it's actually more than $15,000, because there's going to be fees and other things attached to it. Who's going to pay for George to be on the outside?
Yeah, that's a good question. And by the way, bail is never easy for anyone. And I point out in our society, nothing is easy for any American in this economy, let alone a demand to get a child out of jail for this kind of money. So when you look at that as the uphill chore that it is, you ask yourself, what's going to happen? I suspect that somebody out there is going to look upon this with a great deal of dissatisfaction and come to his aid. And I think that I know I personally have seen this throughout my life, that somebody will get up and say, I don't think he's being fairly treated, and I don't think it's fair that he can't raise his bail, and I'm going to do something.
That person would sure be on the front page of every newspaper and on every show, wouldn't they?
Well, yeah, but it'll probably be anonymous. So people who do that generally, unless there's some agenda like Fox, and, you know, you can never can tell. You might have someone like Fox.
No. I can think of one person who loves to stroke himself, Donald Trump. What?
Not even Trump would leap into this one.
Peter Manny,
go ahead.
Zimmerman's lawyer's got to be costing a fortune. If they can't pay for the bond, how are they paying for him? Or is he taking this case because he'll get more cases for it and for the advertising type?
Well, I think this was a pro bono case. It was certainly a pro bono case for the two idiots who ran off at the mouth during, you know, when they found they weren't going to have their lifetime of publicity.
I don't tell them.
Well, yeah, and they had never met him, and they weren't being paid by him, and yet they sold him down the river. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's quite often. Tom Misro, who's been quoted quite often on this, and I noticed he was quoted discussing the various strategies in this case. Tom takes those cases all the time for a variety of different people, specifically some of the national defense organizations who provide defenses for African-Americans who can't afford it. And Tom's been known to go to small towns, and for example, in Alabama, where he defended a black man who was a young man who was basically, I would decide, described as picked out of a questionable lineup, not unlike the cases we all see being reversed right now, and defends him and doesn't get paid. And there's a number of criminal attorneys who do this. And, yes, they get more publicized cases like Michael Jackson, his case, and Robert Blake that provide him a great deal of income. But a lot of these guys are sincerely committed, certainly much more than the civil attorneys I know. And you may disagree with me on that one, Peter, but I think that a great many of the criminal lawyers really are more devoted than civil lawyers are.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, especially with the good ones. And if you're a really good criminal defense attorney, then you have reasons for doing what you do that are not just based in money. This O'Mara strikes me as a very good attorney. And I'm sure that a large part of what he's getting is in compensation is the advertisement, the free advertisement. You can't even put a price tag on it for something like this. This is great advertisement because you're targeting a market on a national scale, and it works when you have, you know, you're a specialist like this.
Gentlemen, do you think that you'll see the Zimmerman family put up a website or some sort of plea for anonymous donations, whether they're $5 or $5?
Wouldn't surprise me at all.
They have one. Oh, I did not know that.
Well, I'm not sure it's still up. I believe that the site was put up by George Zimmerman prior to him turning himself in. I don't have the URL, but it was help me. Here's my PayPal account.
You had one. How do you do with it?
I don't know.
Does it have like a Ron Paul thing, how much money he's raised by the minute?
Right.
He does. Ron Paul's website, it goes up every second and blinks how much money he's raised so far.
I would have to research it. It was a couple of weeks ago, and I saw it, and I went, oh, that's interesting.
I think, you know, what you said, Manny, and I think he would. I think you, if people could give anonymously to a website like that, he probably would raise more than $15,000.
I think he's gonna collect money from people. It's and some people will want to do it anonymously. They won't want to be publicly linked to it. I think the next potential scandal comes down the pike when some name is revealed and it's somebody who's supposed to be detached from it who might be putting money into that. Into that hat, that scandal may break sometime down the line. But for the most part, I think he'll be able to collect or raise the money if he can't get it from his family.
Do you gentlemen
well,
think that
I have a theory that a major contributor might be the Anonymous Rifle Association.
They're probably throwing a few free targets too. But no, I don't know that everybody would want to remain secretive about making a donation. I'm not really inclined, but I don't think I would hide it. If you believe that he deserves a fair trial and you want to contribute money, this is America. You have an absolute right to do so, and I think those people that are committed to do that will thumb their nose to those people, and in fact might even consider those people who oppose, for example, Reverend Sharpton, might consider it an affair of honor to do that. So I'm not sure it's true. I'm really not. You either, Peter?
No, I don't. I think that's fairly true. I think there are many people who are going to want to sign in big letters on the donation list, and I do think there may be some who will want to give and not be known about it. I think for the most part, people who are going to want to give to him are going to do so for precisely the reasons you say. They're proud of it, and they want to shove it in somebody else's nose. And speaking of Reverend Sharpton, I can't – every time we mention his name, I remember the Tawana Bradley case.
You said it.
Yeah. And that's the thing that always comes to my mind every time I think of Reverend Sharpe. I think about the Tawana Bradley case. And, you know, to me, I wouldn't want him in my corner just as a result of that alone. But obviously there are people who feel very differently.
He should be able to reinvent
himself after that. Peter, why don't you give us the thumbnail sketch of that case?
Well, the thumbnail sketch of the Tawana Bradley case was I was working in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill from 87 to 89, and that's when this case arose. And it involved a very attractive African-American cheerleader at a Virginia high school. And she disappeared, and she emerged two or three days later, and she was naked. She had racial slurs written on her body with fecal matter, and she gave an account of how she was basically abducted and raped by KKK members. And Reverend Sharpton was one of the immediate spokespeople who emerged on her behalf, and then it later became apparent that all of this was basically arranged, that they had put all of this together, and the conclusion was that none of it had happened. It was all done to basically generate media attention.
Peter, didn't they actually name a name, and that guy's career got kind of destroyed?
I don't remember. Yeah, I don't remember it in that detail, but you correct me. Did I misremember anything?
It was either they named somebody or the count, or there was a white, and it was a white person. The county prosecutor refused to deal with it correctly, it was either the one they named or the person refused to do anything and started poking holes in their the hoax. That's what it was, a hoax. And that person's career really got sidetracked because Sharpton and his lick spittles wouldn't let go of it. So that they kept beating the drum to keep themselves in power and make money.
Yeah, well, it was a political move. Hoax is giving it too nice a paint. It was an attempt to, it was a hoax, but it was an attempt to create a political agenda and a political point of view. And I forget it was Sharpton, and he had another person who was working with him closely on it, whose name I can't remember. But they both are sort of synonymous in my mind with making a statement about race. And, I'm sure they feel that they need to make these statements for reasons that they feel are justified. But it's always difficult for me to view them with credibility after this, because this was a real uproar. I remember in the D.C., Virginia area. I mean, we were appalled. We were shocked. This was horrible. And then to find out that this was all basically contrived was a real, just a devastating blow. He really felt taken advantage of.
Well, I lived far from it, and I felt the same way all the way over here. I really did. I thought, when you conspire to make news, when the news isn't the truth, you really, to me, that's criminal. And I don't know any other way to describe it. And I'm sure each of you feels much the same way. Our country has enough problems without people manufacturing them.
I never knew why he wasn't prosecuted. I felt it was criminal.
Yeah, that's a great story. Not only was he prosecuted, he ran for president. He stole money from that account. I mean, he's had the IRS up his, you know what. He's done all sorts of illegal things, yet there he is.
Well, you must remember that Adam Clayton Powell was reelected every year, too.
Yeah. Well, Eugene Debs never was.
Was he from Ohio?
No. I don't know where Debs was. I think he was from California, Manny.
Eugene Debs? No, he wasn't. I believe he was from...
Let me see. He ran on this... I don't know where he was from. But he was in jail. He was in jail, but he never got elected.
Yeah.
No, but Justin Powell, considering what Adam Powell.
Clayton
Powell did...
Yeah.
And what Al Sharpton, and you can't compare, it's like comparing apples and oranges. I mean, Sharpton's he's a race baiter. He's bad news. I think he's done crooked things. But he gets paid for it. It's almost like they pay. It's like he's the front man. Everyone knows what he is. And Peter used a great word, credibility. Why does Al Sharpton have any credibility?
Well, I don't think he does.
I don't think he's trying to have credibility in a certain audience. I think he has a lot of credibility in another audience, and that's why some of these officials get elected. You know, we had a mayor in Washington at the time, Marion Barry. And you know, his audience, his market, his electorate, they wanted him to do things like this. And I'm certain at a certain level, Sharpton justifies it by saying, okay, yeah, I made this up. It's not like this didn't happen. It happened to someone, somewhere, sometime. I need to make a point. And, you know, I'm only guessing, but I imagine that's what goes through his mind. And there's a certain market that says, yeah, that's right, an audience. My market isn't the right term. An audience who says, that's right, that's true. It didn't happen on this occasion, but this stuff happens sometimes, all the time, everywhere. It's happened before, and we want to make a point. That's the best.
You take it one step further. As I pointed out, there were three people killed in Los Angeles County. I mean, who knows how many people killed? Their parents aren't flown into Congress for congressional subcommittee hearing. I mean, why did that happen? I just that boggled my mind as a
it's a political lightning rod right now.
Yeah, and
political
and
lightning.
We've got to stop this stuff because it's ruined. As Manny points out all the time, it's a real soft underbelly to the country, the fabric of the country that's fraying everywhere.
Absolutely. You know, and by the way, when I thought about it, I know Eugene Debs, who a great union leader, was born in Terre Haute, Indiana. He was one of my longtime clients was and used to tell me about the monument to him. And I spaced on that for a moment. I knew it was Ohio or one of them. And part of this is Eugene Debs is one of the founders of all the major of the union system that we basically have now today. So if you don't like our system of unionism, you can blame him. He was a major driver in it.
Yeah, he also ran, he was the head of the Socialist Party, too.
That's correct.
Okay.
He one time held office in Indiana for those people who are into history.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Simon.
It took Al Sharpton less than a bite of okra to get involved with the Trayvon Martin case. And I noticed that our good friend Jesse Jackson wasn't far behind. I mean, what axe do these people have to grind in the case? I mean, they've managed to take a pretty simple situation and blow it out of all proportion.
Well, that's what they do for a living.
Right.
They have made their living seizing upon these moments politically, and, you know, I guess, concerned that the unemployment is high in the minority community, it's a good way to maintain your employment over a long period of time.
Okay, I can't certainly say what goes through in their mindsets, but I think at some level they feel like they need to make these points in order to bring about what they believe to be necessary social change. That's the only thing that I can, my mind sees when I see this kind of thing.
You know, Peter, I think you attribute too much to them.
I do, but I choose to attribute more because I want to give them the benefit of the doubt. And I think 90% of what they do is probably self-serving, but I do think there's some element of it somewhere. I'm hoping that has a higher purpose.
Yeah, so people don't feel that I'm drawing some line that is maybe even racially motivated. I feel that way, the same way about people on the right who seize these same opportunities to advance either the agenda of the American Rifle Association or some other group because it just happens to fit with their political beliefs. So we have a society right now that really makes decisions based upon what they think they can do to gain greater public notoriety, and that's really a shame.
It is
really
a shame.
If I had $10 to contribute, I'd give it to Al Sharpton rather than the NRA, but yeah, it's just my personal view.
You probably lost 5 listeners with that. They will never speak to you again. No, you know, people should give to whether they believe in. And the simple fact is that racism, you were suppressed for a while and everybody thought it was going away. I felt the Bush administration's policies brought it to the surface for better or worse, and frankly, it probably did us a favor and got it back out in the open again. And the simple fact is that the minute you have your economy take a dip, whoever's the short end of the pole is going to feel the greatest sting, and poverty is a great equalizer. So what we have is a system that is just creating this. So racial disharmony, it's the same thing happened after the Civil War. African Americans moved north looking for jobs, and they were resented, not because they were black, but because they were competing for the same jobs as mine, as others were in the North. And that was a problem, if you recall.
Oh, indeed. But I don't like what I'm seeing at the moment. It's stupidity.
I think it's all stupidity when you look at it. Because what happens is this doesn't solve the problem. And that's the point that everybody's missing. None of this conversation takes one step forward to solving the problem. The intervention by Sharpton just raises the radical opposite side who oppose him, and they in turn respond by taking a radical position. And before the day is done, we've reversed everybody to an opposite position, and we forget that what we're talking about here is justice. And it makes it harder and harder to carry out the ends of justice. Right, Peter?
Well, it certainly is getting very difficult. That's very true. It's very hard to try to get to the right result when you've got all this other stuff getting in the way. And it's very hard. And I deal with it every day. And Manny, I know you deal with it. We all deal with it every single day.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, but I tell you what we have to do today is we're going to have to close this down because we're just having too good a time and going a long time. But I must tell our viewers, Trayvon Martin is here to stay. And so if you're not tired of this conversation, you better come back and see us next week, because we think this is going to go on in a way that's going to keep all of us involved in this. And I hope both Sam and Peter come back and join us often, because the more they follow this, hopefully the more we refine our opinions and the more opportunity we have to really comment on the wider group of things that are occurring. So, Simon, do you have any last thoughts before we start checking everybody out here?
My final thoughts? I think this is a stupid case that's been completely overblown. It's going to be fun to watch it unfold and probably explode. I see prosecutors that are inept, and I see truly, truly clever defenders. I love it.
And don't forget the element of surprise, because there's still a lot we don't know. Peter, what do you think?
All I can think of are the words of Robert Frost when he talked about the world ending with a whimper instead of a bang. And something tells me that's where we're going with this case. But perhaps I'm reading too much into it or applying too much literature to it. But I have a funny feeling it's all going to fizzle out.
I don't. How about you, Sam?
Well, first of all, thanks for the opportunity. It was not being a lawyer, it was interesting hearing two lawyers, very good lawyers, talk about certain things and, you know, help me to broaden my horizons in regards to this. I'm with Peter. I think this thing has already hit its high watermark, and a lot of it's there is not much there. It's just gonna it is gonna fizzle out. That's what I want. That's what I hope happens.
But well, just
I do
so
feel
clear.
What Simon says.
When I mean fizzle out, I mean
Simon
the prosecution.
Says a riot, you know, and bad news, and it could be bad news for this country at this time.
Yeah, I mean the case, but I think the uproar over it, the crescendo will continue, but I think eventually the case will need a kind of fizzle.
If I got you right, the case really, it is much ado about, as Shakespeare said, it was bad, someone got killed, but I think that he was justified based upon what I said. Maybe his, Manny's right, maybe there is a smoking gun there, pun intended, that no one knows about. But I think what's going to happen is the crescendo is going to go, because what we just talked about, these people are all self-serving for the most part. They want to be banging the drum. But there's only so much evidence and all that stuff that's going to be there. And if it favors Zimmerman, as it looked like it did on Friday, then I think there is going to be a cooling off period. And it's going to fizzle out, and the election's going to come, and that'll be that.
Well, you know, I'm going to offer a slightly different view. I hope it doesn't fizzle out, because one of the benefits to the states that nobody's really discussing is that it may cause change in our society. And the change that people think about are involve race, but that's not the change on my mind. The change in my mind is I have found over a period of time certain states, and I often talk about Texas and Florida having laws that are completely different than everyone else. So when these events occur, people have trouble putting it in a frame of reference because they don't see or understand the difference in the laws across the country. And I'm hoping this is going to bring that into focus for people, and they begin to understand why we need to make our laws more consistent and why we need to prevent some jurisdictions from having laws that the rest of the country don't feel are appropriate. And there in lines one of the issues, in my opinion, with the state of Florida, is it functions in a manner and basically deals with law that most Americans don't agree with. And hopefully this will all come to the surface, and we will look at it differently. Simon, you want to have last thoughts before we go?
Gentlemen, I want to really thank you for taking part this afternoon. I'm sure that we'll be picking this conversation up again soon. So thank you, Manny. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Sam. Let's keep in touch, and who knows where we'll take this next time. Till next time, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy and safe weekend and a happy and safe week. We'll be back next Sunday. Till then, goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.